Thank you very much. But I'm not talking of myself today. So first, what this talk is about, it's something that I've always found confusing because the name is badly chosen. There's something called inertial manifold. Theorems are proven about it. And you're told that for Kuramoto-Shiva-Shensky, for some special cases, it's finite dimensional. I never understood whether that meant that it has finite Hausdorff dimension, but it's every place anyhow, or did it mean something finite dimensional? So rest assured, it's a body bag, you know. You have your dead fish, very complicated, strange attractor. It's inside a finite dimensional bag like this one, and it's embedded in many, many dimensions. But for systems that we are interested in, dissipative systems, it's a really finite dimensional body bag. Now, you know, why are we here? We would like to understand what happens in extreme dimensions, in very high or infinite dimensions for PDEs. And we would like to do it without statistical assumptions. We would like to just work out consequences of equations like Navier-Stokes. Now, why am I talking? I should not be talking, and I'm really not talking as myself. Organizers are not allowed to talk, but John Gibson and I decided there is a thing that we wanted this community to hear, and we want to work on ourselves, which is very beautiful and very nice, and I think you should know about it. And naturally, you don't hear about it because communities are disjoint. So the people who have done this work are statistical physics. They are, you know, interested in spatiotemporal chaos, coupled lattices, stuff like that, and maybe you are not exposed to, but I was lucky enough to be invited to one of their meetings. And it's really, the brilliant idea is, I don't know who, but you know, in this group of people, Ginelli, Chatea, Radon, Spoliti, Poggi, Turkey, and there are two steps in it. First is algorithmic, and it's linear algebra, but it's very impressive to me, this linear algebra. And what they did is they, 10 years ago, they published an algorithm how to compute what they call Lyapunov covariant vectors. And there's a custom in our community that every time you talk about stability, you call it Lyapunov, but poor man has nothing, Russian nobleman has nothing to do with this. These are just, what they discovered is that the Jacobian matrix has eigenvectors. And they decide to call them Lyapunov covariant vectors. But they're just eigenvectors of Jacobian. And they're the right object, you know. Why is that a big deal? Because before that, they believed that you should take Jacobian, multiply it by its transpose, and you look at some singular vectors, and, you know, they don't mean anything. But that's what they used to do before. So now it became covariant Lyapunov vectors. And I hope you'll appreciate a little while, why is it a big deal? They can compute all of them for a given, you know, 100,000, well, at least 1,000 dimensional truncation of a problem. And they're non-normal, and they move with the flow. And then there's a beautiful insight, which I want to tell you about if you're not aware of it, that, you look at this linearized flow that we are all very used to. There are some eigenvectors that move with the trajectory. The trajectory, this is a ergodic trajectory, so this goes back to Osoledek. You know, for them to be invariant, the trajectory has to be infinite back in time and forth in time, and then you have really good notion of stable, unstable linearizations in the neighborhood. And what they discovered, and I hope it's true, they have, you know, it's a numerical discovery, and it might turn out that it won't survive by the time they get to Navier-Stokes, but they discovered that the neighborhood, the linearized neighborhood of ergodic trajectory is hyperbolically separated into two parts. One part they call physical, but that word is abused a lot, so I'll call it entangled in this talk, because it's just linear algebra and physics is a big subject, a word that's not abused very much. But the other one is totally okay, transient, you know. So there are directions in which you kick your neighboring just comes back without any further fuss. But the entangled one is fussy. And they showed numerically again, and I'll show you a little bit how it works, that it works for one-dimensional PDEs. So a relative of Navier-Stokes, but a poor relative called Kuramoto-Shirashinsky. And then, you know, you could say, well, that has Laplacian squares, so it's special, etc. But it also showed it was complex Ginzburg-Landau, which only has Laplacian. So it's looking more like fluid dynamics. It worked. And Navier-Stokes is interesting because people who prove existence of, rigorously existence of inertial manifolds can do it for Navier-Stokes. But this is a different way to think about it. So maybe this will open a way of proving some rigorous results, but that's not obvious. And here is, you know, the slide that was a killer slide for me, and I'll try to explain it to you in the rest of the talk. So, thank you. So, this is Kuramoto-Shirashinsky spectrum of stability eigenvalues, which in this case it actually is Lyapunov spectrum. And what's plotted here, this comes from the paper of Young et al. From 2009, is the values of the Lyapunov exponents. And on this plot you can see, but some of them are positive, some of them are above zero. Lots of them are negative, but not very negative. And then there is a sharp shoulder, and you fall off the cliff. So there's a sharp separation, is what they call physical dimensions and transient dimensions. And this has a beautiful scaling. If you double, so you think of it as a long pipe, if you wish, and L20 is kind of small domain that we work in when we work in Navier-Stokes. So this is rather long pipe. It's four times longer than small domain, and then you double the length. And what happens is when you double the length, the number of physical dimensions just doubles. So these are these blue dots within the red squares. And you know, the rest is in this transient stuff, which I'll argue is not of importance when you look at inertial manifold. And then you say, you know, maybe my resolution is not good enough. So let me just double the number of computational modes for a given L. And then what happens is, all these guys that you produce in here, they produce more eigenvalues, but they all sit in the transient part. So the physical part is totally robust, and if you have sufficient resolution, it just stays that. And if you resolve it more and more, you just produce more crap over here, but that's not physical. So that's, you know, take home for you. And if you could do it in Navier-Stokes, I'll tell you, this will be, you know, you'll be handsomely rewarded. You know, your life will be much simpler. And the basic picture that you should keep in mind about this body bag is that there is the state space that we all work in with, and you know, we don't have much choice. We have some computational methods in which we discretize PDE, and we do it more or less cleverly, but they cannot do it very cleverly. So, you know, we might be in 100,000 or million computational elements, but when we look at the solutions, they don't look that complicated. It doesn't look like you need 100 million pixels to show the things that we have been looking at in the talks at this conference. So that means inside of that space, there is some curved manifold, which will be this inertial manifold. And as I look at that manifold, there are two kinds of perturbations of that manifold. There must be, is there a, yeah. So there are perturbations which we call transient, which is, you know, I throw something out, it just falls back on the table. Boom. It doesn't do anything complicated. It just falls in. But then there are these things which you call entangled mode, and important about is they're both stable and unstable. You know, our intuition is that unstable directions are very important and stable are less important. Well, it turns out that intuition is not very good for nonlinear systems, because what can happen in a nonlinear flow, and that's kind of illustrated, this is just, you know, a case where inertial manifold is two-dimensional. There are these places here where what used to be stretching every place suddenly meets so-called tangency or turnback, where you, this unstable manifold has to struggle against stable manifold. And stable manifold can win for a while, but as you go around, you might start stretching again, you know, so you can have chaoticity even this. And these entanglements are totally crucial. Now, I can draw this, because this is just a known attractor, and you can draw these pictures. I don't know how to draw them when inertial or physical entangled manifold is 100-dimensional, but I believe that's what goes on. Every so often, they're non-hyperbolistic, so that the things that look nicely expanding, you know, along some eigendirection of the flow, encounter some other eigendirection of the flow, and they get entangled, and my perturbations move across this attractor, but they don't leave it. Anything that goes out goes in. Now, this is hard to draw. So from now on, you know, I'll tell you what the content of this is just by drawing it flat. But the idea is, this is really 100,000 dimensions. You know, 27 dimensions are this way, and the red lines are within these 27 dimensions, and the blue guys are in the rest. And this part is called inertial manifold, and the rest is called the transient manifold. And now, the inertial manifold is every place locally spanned by these entangled tangent vectors, some of them extracting, some of them contracting, and the rest is, you know, lots of stuff which when I look at long time behavior doesn't participate in it, because all of it dies, so everything goes within the body bag. So that's the idea. And if this is correct, then it means that my huge space, you know, infinite dimensional PDE, has a bunch of exact invariant solutions in it, you know, not necessarily equilibria, but, you know, whatever, periodic solutions, etc. And each one of them owns a brick. There is a block which is 20 dimensional, let's say, even though I have 100,000 dimensions, and all the interesting stuff happens with these 20 dimensions. And when I leave one neighborhood, there'll be the next brick, and I'll just interchange my map, and I'll go from Alabama to Georgia, and I'll use that map, and I'll continue doing it, and cover the world. So if it works, it's kind of amazing, right? Because, and we need something like that, because we cannot go to large systems without some idea how to deal with it. So far, even rather small systems, we need lots of coupled ordinary differential equations. Now, if this is true, we might be able to tunnel much, much larger inertial manifolds by using the intrinsic low dimensionality. Now, you know, I haven't done it, fingers crossed, but I think that's why we should listen to these people. I think it's pretty brilliant and beautiful. So, you know, our problems of this kind, we have seen nice pictures. I, you know, happen to have this one. And there are two ways of looking at them. So as humans, we look at them in configuration space of two or three dimensions. As we do the necessary computation mathematics, we have to be in a state space, which is infinite dimensional. And, you know, we evolve things in that state space. And to get intuition, and this has been true for much of the work on the kind of solutions that we are interested in, sometimes it's useful to not do Navier-Stokes immediately, but to look at some closer relatives, you know, Burgers might be one, etc. This one, it has a wrong diffusion. So, you know, instead of friction, it explodes you. But then you have this hyperviscosity term, and it's a nice equation. It has only one parameter, which acts as a Rel number, which is the size of the domain. And a typical solution on large space time, so this is space and this is time, solution has a property that it's every place unstable, but every place looks the same. You know, it has some kind of characteristics. When some things happen, you know, it doesn't really look that complicated. And we will work on small domain, just as we do in fluid dynamics, for the same reason. On the small domain, we can do large calculations. So this is a bunch of, this is a solution, you know, long time on a small domain. So we go to time 1000, where typical time for this problem turnover time is of order 10. And, you know, same stuff keeps happening. So it's weakly turbulent, spatiotemporally chaotic in this sense as a model. Now, if you go to state space and we find some exact solution, Burak has shown this very nicely in the previous talk, they look, even the simplest solutions look like a mess. It turns out it has to do with the symmetries, so you have to quotient symmetries once you do them. By the way, the work I'll report now is done by Sean Ding, a very gifted graduate student at Georgia Tech. Once you have removed all the symmetries and you have lots of solutions, and you know, instead of 20 or 40 that we tend to have in fluid dynamics, here we have 60,000 relative periodic orbits to play with, and all calculations are done on set of roughly 500. It's very easy to find beautiful examples of shadowing. So this is three orbits projected in some, you know, convenient coordinates from, in this case, truncation to 60 dimension, where it's, which is good enough for Kuramoto-Shepashinsky calculations, to some three dimensions. And you can see that they can shadow each other very nicely. So the long orbit of length 80, you know, for a while is shadowed by this guy, and then it's shadowed by that guy. So you can see that we might be able to cover the phase space nicely by these periodic solutions. And in this case, you know, we can make more of an argument. So this is actually from Burak's PhD thesis. When you look in a configuration space, typical solution, it does whatever it does. But when you look at it, a Poincaré section with symmetry reduced and as explained in previous talk, you can see that this is actually a rather thin object, the strange attractor that attracts this object. And what's plotted here is, you know, one color, green, is just an ergodic trajectory piercing some cleverly chosen Poincaré section. And the blue guys are 480 periodic orbits, which pierce that section, you know, a few thousand times. And you can see that they're capturing the geometry of the turbulent flow. So you can see that using invariant solutions might be the way to describe what happens in this flow. Now, having said the computation, you know, what's the dimension? I'll give you six arguments why we are computing the dimension. And it still might be wrong because it's all numerical. And it could be that something will happen in Navier-Stokes that hasn't happened in Kuramoto-Shepashinsky. So take it with a grain of salt, but I find it very impressive. So first, I'll tell you what was done by people who had the original idea, which is Ginelli, Chatet, Radons, Takeuchi, etc. And then I'll, this is the first 2 points, and then I'll tell you what we can contribute with our ideas, our community. And the idea, you know, calculation is very simple. You look at some orbit and trajectory, and you linearize on the orbit. So this is not a linear problem. This is just a linearization of neighborhood of a highly nonlinear problem. And this matrix here tells you how small neighborhoods get deformed. That's called the Jacobian. And when you do this in high dimensions and you go from minus to plus infinity with ergodic orbit, you know, you start with finite time stretches, and then you have to do all kinds of clever tricks with orthogonalizing frames, etc. I'll come back to the second. And they're able to compute the set of eigenvectors and eigenvalues for that ergodic trajectory very well. And a thing that happens is, and here I need your help because I don't understand it myself because it's a little bit counterintuitive. What you do now is you have your orbit and you have the eigenvectors. Now what the flow does is it moves the eigenvectors and they actually change their directions. It's not an orthogonal frame, they're non-normal. And they move along, 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 and you look at the leading eigenvector and the next leading red and green, and at some point, blip, as far as you can tell, they become parallel. And I'll quantify this. Now, this is very counterintuitive for us because they have different eigenvalues, so they're supposed to be, you know, they cannot get parallel by linear algebra that we're familiar in. But they don't care, they, you know, seem to go parallel and then they go on and do something and they'll do this often. And I don't understand it and I feel that we are not using good mathematics to describe what happens when the linearity in some sense is failing us. But you can do lots of numerical experiments on Kuramoto-Shivashinsky because we have such a good data set, such good control over it. And here is what happens, and that's the essence of their separation. So usually when people talk about dimensionality, if you're very naive, you say, you know, if I have seven unstable eigenvalues, I say my flow is seven dimensional because stable eigenvalues take care of themselves. But if it's a nonlinear flow, you realize it's not quite right, then there is this thing that's called Kaplan-York dimension, which comes from no place and has no justification, but it's so easy that everybody can use it. It says, well, you know, yeah, but if the contraction is not strong enough, then the volume spanned by seven expanding directions is expanding, and I add more and more unstable directions until the volume contracts. And I say, when that happens, I give it a name, Kaplan-York, and if I want to screw around with fractals, I do something extra so it's non-integer, but basically it's an integer dimension. Well, it's wrong. It turns out that the physical dimension is twice, in the example that we worked out, twice the Kaplan-York. So, you know, it was not an idea and it doesn't work out. But this one has a kind of thing that you could do in fluid dynamics if you wanted to do it. And that is that you take these vectors, you run them, and you keep computing angles between the vectors. And you produce a histogram of this. And the histogram is very surprising to me. So in this particular case, the first seven have a property that when you come to very small angles, this is zero angle and this is pi over two, when you come to very small angles, they don't care. You know, they're very likely to be almost zero angle. There is no dip. You know, you would expect because they're different eigenvalues, the things should be repelling, shouldn't do it. But the distribution of these angles is flat, pairwise for a second, second, third, fourth, etc. When you get to what was the edge on that plot, and suddenly, the other vectors can get to zero. So the other guys, the transient ones, the angles as you move around are always, Lorette, yes, make it short. This is Lorette from ICPC, NCPC, PC, Paris.
Right, Lorette Tuckerman, ESPCI. Okay, I just want to understand these curves. There are seven eigenvectors, and so there are 42 angles between them, yes? And you're talking about a distribution. What are those curves?
These curves are slightly a cheat, and I'll define them precisely in a little while, but morally what they are, I take the most leading eigenvector next to leading eigenvector, and I run it for eternity, and I beam the angles between them.
So the curves, that's you've sampled it by going along the trajectory, and you're taking the top two. Okay, thank you.
And then I take second and third, or third and fourth, and when I get the seventh one, the next one is almost orthogonal to it. It likes to be over there to descend. And there's some theorem that anybody in computer science knows that if I take two random vectors in a large dimensional space, they're orthogonal. Any two random vectors are orthogonal. And the width of this statement, the Gaussian distribution of these angles around 90 degrees is the number of dimensions. It's an elementary thing that computer scientists know in data, big data. So these guys behave like this. These extra vectors, they all seem like random vectors, etc. So that's what they discovered, and I find it incredibly, because it's a sharp criterion, it's not very fuzzy. Now, I have objection about that. I don't have an objection, but I would like to know more. So what they do is they sit like in Dr. Strangelove, you're sitting on this rocket and you just keep going. And you're measuring the space locally, and it's flat. And you say, 20 dimensions are this, and the rest is that, locally. But where am I? Because I know that this thing is embedded in something. It sits someplace. It's not some wild ride. It has structures. So where are we? And it's a roller coaster ride. But now I'll tell you, we who are used to things that they're not used to, because they would never compute a periodic orbit on a very large lattice, etc. Because why would they do that? Because they just run their computers forward in time and everybody's happy. We have developed a habit that we want to find some structures in there. And the idea is that what we know how to do, we know that the space is being filled out by ergodic motion in some way. But it's some part of the space, and within it there are some points which I would like to call, following Rich, I like his expression, I would like to call them recurrent flaws, because it's kind of soft and fuzzy and non-committal and nobody gets mad. For some reason you have decided to call them exact coherent structures, so everybody, there are like four questions every time you say this word and you have to justify yourself. We call them recurrent flaws, they say, it's recurrent, it's flaw, it's fine. And they happen to be exact coherent structures, but I really like the way Rich calls them. So we can actually use these guys, and the picture is very, very elementary. The flow is some nonlinear thing. If I take a plane, it does something to it. And we know that when it's turbulent or chaotic, it's complicated. But if you look at our exact solutions, equilibria, cycles, they're actually very rigid. They're just shapes that we recognize. There's a repertoire of shape turbulence explorers, and these guys pin out particular ones. So that's why we sometimes call them templates, calling, following Marsden and Rowe, et cetera. And then they have linear neighborhoods, and we have very good control over them. So what you can think about is that you fill the space with your recurrent flows, you compute their linear neighborhoods, and you use them as your roadmaps. So if you're in this neighborhood, you do something, and if you go too far, there's a ridge, the two maps, it's not two-dimensional pieces of paper, but 20 dimensions, there's a co-dimensionless interface, and I just switch my map and I keep going. So that's what I would like to do, cover the world with these bricks. And to do this, Sean Ding had to invent a method. Now, he read the literature, so he feels he plagiarized the literature because it was already done by Schur. So this is what I'll present, Sean Ding's calculation, which is plagiarism, which is, how to compute eigenvectors, Fourier vectors for periodic orbits. Now, you think it's no big deal because Gibson and his code can do first 30, up to one digit of precision. But no, here we need to know them to lots of digits and very precisely. And to give you some sense, this is the spectrum. So these are so-called Lyapunov exponents, so rate of change per unit time. And these are, phases, not so important. These guys are important. And this is the shortest periodic orbit. And now the Lyapunov exponents for Kuramoto-Shirashinsky, not Navier-Stokes, which we have to compute hundreds of them. They range from something of order 0.1 to 320, which means that when I look at flow k multipliers, well, the first unstable direction has grown by factor of 2. The 62nd direction has gone down by 10 to the 30,000. So you can't just write an idiotic computer program. You have to do this level by level to do. There's a beautiful program done by Gibson, but we'll have to tweak it for this. So the problem is this spectra is that it's just linear algebra, and they've done it for ergodic trajectories, but it's not very smart. And Schur has done it for periodic orbits or for products of matrices in cyclic blocks. That's the Schur version. And we can compute them to machine precision. Look at, all these digits are good. Every one of them is good. So that needs to be done, and that's, Schoending did beautiful work doing it. And now, a nice thing happens. You're looking at a small domain, and we always worry, small domains, what do they have to do with extended flows? They could be very, very, because we're doing exactly the same thing. We're periodic, our pipe is one diameter long, and we would like to know what happens for 500 diameters. It's very short one. An amazing thing that happens is that for this little short guy, so there are computations we've done for more, but they're just computations for two kinds of periodic orbits, pre-pure, that doesn't matter. And that stuff stratifies itself exactly like for very long systems, which I'll show you in a second. And there are two things. There is a bunch of eigenvalues which, all look marginal, but when you look at them, actually, two unstable, three unstable, some, and different periodic orbits can have different number of unstable eigenvalues, stable ones. But they all have the same physical number up to this threshold, and then things fall off. So on level of eigenvalues, there's some nonsense going on with first one as you move around, and everybody else is cleanly separated. For Kuramoto-Shirashinsky. So then a crazy thing happens. If it's true, we are really lucky. It turns out it's enough to compute one periodic orbit and do the stratification on it because all 500 gave us the same answer. If this is true, we'll be in good shape in Navier-Stokes. We won't have to work very hard, but I have no idea why that's really true, but I'm just reporting it here. So then more serious things come. This just shows you that we know how to move the tangent spaces and periodic orbits projected. And now the more honest answer to Laurette Tuckerman from ICPSSFMFSA. What we actually do is we take the first n eigenvectors, and that defines a linear space. Then we look at the complement of that space. And we compute the principal angle between the two spaces. So that's what's actually plotted here. That can be done by, plagiarizing literature because you use methods of linear algebra discovered previously. And that's how this was really computed. So this is computed in periodic orbit. Now, this is all just about eigenvalues and eigenvectors, so we felt very unsure about it, so we kept beating at it. So I'll show you a few other versions of it, which are harder to do. So then you said, okay, if this is really true, an ergodic trajectory comes close to my periodic point that I'm using to define my slab, it should sit within that subspace. You know, it shouldn't be sitting outside of it. So we check this in two more ways by looking at separation vectors. So is the separation vector sitting in the 20-dimensional or 8-dimensional subspace, or does it poke outside? And here come, you know, difficult plots of kind you see in physics of letters, but what is going on here is that there are these colors, blue, etc., where we don't have enough eigenvectors to span the entangled space. And when that happens, my angles are not small. So all this blue stuff says, you know, if I don't have enough vectors to span the neighborhood of my periodic point, periodic orbit, then the angles of ergodic trajectories will be not small because, you know, I'll be poking outside of this space. But when I get to sufficiently, which in this case happens to be 8 and higher, then, you know, everything is behaving nicely. This is this color here. It says I come closer, you know, everything is getting more and more contained within the subspace. So we feel quite confident about it. Now you might worry, okay, this is a small cell. You're computing this in a small domain. You know. Does it work for the chaos? We would like to do spatial temporal chaos or long pipes or long areas. And you know, those things intuitively, they should be extensive because if I take a sufficiently large block and take some other block of a long pipe, they all look the same if it's fully turbulent state in some sense. So you have a feeling that if I double the length of the pipe, if I'm lucky, I just only have to double the number of dimensions to describe it, so physical dimension. Now, if you look at mathematical proofs about these things, they give you limits. You know, the greatest proof for which people get prizes says that as I make Kuramoto-Shiva-Shinsky bigger, the number of degrees of freedom is less than length to the 1.7, let's say. But it turns out to be linear, and that's what I found amazing about this original work. You know, you just double the size of the domain, and you just need twice as many degrees of freedom. Not obvious a priori that would happen, but that means that, you know, we could go to, if we are able to produce small bricks to cover the attractor, we might be able to go to much larger systems than we do. So to summarize, it turns out that just studying linearized neighborhoods or ergodic orbits or unstable periodic orbits, you can split hyperbolically the site into entangled in which all ergodic motion happens and transient, which dies away. So we have a clean definition of inertial manifold. And, you know, this is the long version. And if there's anything you didn't understand, I have an answer for you. And that's it.
Thank you very much. So, thank you very much. You told us lots of things, but not the thing about your sunglasses.
Because I'm Yuk-Shate. Because ideally, Yuk-Shate would be giving this talk, but he would be terribly bored for the rest of the conference because he's not a member of Plumbers International 64 like the rest of us. And so I did work for him. But it's beautiful work, and you know, I really think you should be aware of it, even if you don't use it.
So if I may drop my question, Bruno Eckhardt from Marburg. In fluid mechanics and in turbulence, we kind of know that there is a Kolmogorov scale below which viscosity takes out everything that you put in. So to which extent is this transition between sort of the weakly decaying ones, the ones that you call entangled, and the ones that sort of drop off, the transition from the inertial range to the viscous sub-range?
Professor Eckhardt, I'm very grateful for this question. It's a beautiful and right question. I forgot to say the most important thing. So this is working in the spatiotemporal settings, meaning, for example, we have a plane quiet, the geometrical scale, a working and Reynolds number, which is transitional, but above what we believe is onset of turbulence, or in pipes, you know, yeah, above the transition where the thing is uniformly filled with turbulent motion, but we are no place close to Kolmogorov scales.
There is a Kolmogorov scale.
The features that are captured by this thing are as close to Kolmogorov scale as what we see in a small cell. You know, we don't have very strong features. Reynolds number is small.
So this is not the issue. The issue is that we are this dissipation length.
Yeah.
There comes a cutoff.
Yeah, so you think should give us the dimension.
No, what I'm sort of wondering, I mean, if you do sort of the simple estimate, you count, let's say in your pipe, what's the diameter divided by the Kolmogorov scale. This gives you a number of modes. You do this cube because you have three directions, and this should, order of magnitude-wise, be the number of positive, or the eigenvalues that are entangled. And thereafter, all the other eigenvalues that you have, they're falling off exponentially because they get beaten by viscosity and they're gone.
Okay, so you're thinking of Kolmogorov scale as h-bar in quantum mechanics. There's some basic volume.
There's this paper by David Riel in which he calculates characteristic exponents, and he has exactly that kind of argument. The number of positive exponents comes from sort of the inertial range, and this is cut off at the viscous scale, and that's sort of the number of positive exponents.
But he does not need to have to go to a higher Reynolds number to do this?
The asymptotic scaling is, of course, at high Reynolds number, but you can play the same game at low Reynolds number. I mean, there is a viscous scale at which things are cut off. And the challenge in all DNS is that you have to resolve down to that scale, otherwise the results are not trustworthy.
Yeah. So, you know, I showed you this thing that I found amazing in this killer plot. You know, the killer plot says that if I over-resolve my system, all the degrees of freedom that go into over-resolved system are transient. Somehow, you know, Kolmogorov scale is sitting someplace in here.
It would be sitting right there because all the other ones would be damped away. They would be gone.
Well,
that's the connection. I mean, I don't know whether that's the case, but if you sort of look at...
I mean, you know, revolution will be televised, but I'm not allowed to say it. But Kolmogorov was a wonderful man who lived a long time ago. And we have moved on. I admire him endlessly, you know, but this is, I don't think it's relevant.
I'm not making a statement that he sort of knew this. What I'm trying to ask, and apparently since the calculation hasn't been done, what I sort of see is a connection between this kind of behavior where you have a number of entangled modes.
Chairman, you have to pass the baton to other people to ask questions.
Microphone. All right, good. Who else wants to go? Lorette, way back there.
How did she get there? She was here. She's a quantum state, just like Nigel.
Lorette Chakramani, SPCI. I am in the habit of looking at all equations as perturbations of the heat equation. And then you understand the spectrum very, very well. You have the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, and you can resolve that as much as you want, and as you add extra modes, they will live over there. Is that related to this?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. The spectrum becomes, you know, the spectrum of heat equation, if you wish. You've gone to the scales which are much finer than typical scales of the nonlinear problem has, and you can think of them this way, you know. It's Laplacian spectrum. I totally agree.
So Igor Mezic, UCSB.
Igor.
So, yeah, I know. You don't know.
No, they can hear you on the recording, but I cannot hear
you. Sure. So I'm not sure. I have two questions. One is, did you say that these are the eigenvalues of the Jacobian?
Yeah.
Why are there no complex eigenvalues?
Oh, yeah, sure, there are.
So why is then the argument that the eigenvectors come together when I actually have to think about the complex eigenvectors?
No, you have to do that. No, I'm sorry, you know, to do this sure correctly, and that Schoending had to solve that problem, you know. So when you have degeneracies like that one, you know, it shows up in an algorithm as a pimple. I mean, you have to have blocks that deal with it. Okay. So yes, when there are pairs of eigenvalues, that doesn't count in this thing. They define a hyperplane, a pair of eigenvalues, and you're measuring angle to other hyperplanes. But okay, they do account for them.
And this
and
is
it was
the
a big
part.
Obstacle at the beginning, because, you know, a simple argument says all eigenvalues are real, blah, blah, blah. But no, you have to do that.
And this, and just the briefly second part, and this is the argument, the discussion that was going on here. It is not entirely clear to me that the spectrum of the Jacobian around an ergodic trajectory is the same thing as thinking about the spectrum of the associated PDE, which would be an associated, you know, heat equation or anything like that. And I, actually, maybe I'll say that it's not.
I don't get it. You know, we're in the same space, in the same function space, and, you know, it's a Galerkin truncation of Solling PDE. I mean, you know, we are solving that PDE. We are not doing anything else.
This is just the homework assignment.
I mean, to one who let the mathematician into this room? What's going on?
More questions. John?
Hi, John Gibson, University of New Hampshire. So I've got two entangled questions here. And those are, I can't put together the angles. What's the connection between the angles between the Floquet vectors and the dimensionality of this, you know, the number 8 that you got for the L22? There's that. And the related question is, why do you need the eigenvalues to 16 digits in order to do this calculation?
You know, the real calculation is that you span linear spaces with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 eigenvectors, and you find out what's the first space that contains a ergodic trajectory. So that's, you know, that's what's going on. And then, you know, there is some way to do this, which is you know, how do you know that ergodic trajectory is going out? That you have to define an angle between that space and the complement space. And that's being measured in that. So, you know, that's technical. Now, I don't like it because that is introducing a norm that didn't exist there, because to measure cosine, you have introduced a norm in Euclidean. So it's not good. So there should be more intelligent way to formulate this. There was one question. What was the other one?
Yes, the other one was why you need the
eigenvalues. Oh, yeah, the accuracy. It's psychological, right? Because, you know, we have to make sure that in this particular test case, we can compute that spectrum and nothing weird happens. Now, of course, in fluids, you know, once we cross this threshold, we'll be happy if that threshold is at 100 eigenvectors, because, you know, eigenvectors, you have to think what I mean, but they have to do is this motion, that motion, that motion. So in three dimensions, there'll be more eigenvectors of comparable size, right? When we cross the, let's say, 107, you know, and 108 looks like it's not quite there, you know, we want to go for at least another 30, 40. So when we compute it in that case, first of all, sure, we'll have to be replaced by some Krylov method, because we won't be able, here we use formal matrix, we won't be able to do it. We just have to make sure that, you know, things look okay beyond that horizon. But in this case, we, because the other people can do all of them, we also do all of them, so we don't fall behind. But it's only psychological.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You. Rome.
Rome Grigori of Georgia Tech. So the fact that you can compute eigenvectors, of course, is not a privilege. Sort of, it's luck, right? So the matrix has to be diagonalizable. And it's not guaranteed to be diagonalizable every place. So when the blip happens, you basically, what I assume, is you lose diagonalizability property.
Now, you know, I would really like to have it explained to me, because I feel very uncomfortable about blips, but yeah.
So the way you define things, I hope that the blips happen in the same place in the state space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every state space has its stable unstable manifolds, and
so
they're localized.
The question then is, do you have any intuition about the significance? So, you know, when you lose diagonalizability, you have to define generalized eigenvectors. Do they have any physical meaning or no?
I mean, you tell me. But, you know, the intuition that I have comes from low dimensions. And the intuition is, you know, there I'm used to these blips because I actually have homoclinic. I mean, I have tangences of stable and unstable manifolds. They're very important. They make, this problem, which is just a known attractor, they make it non-hyperbolic. And they also, we do not know where this is a chaotic system. You know, it's quite possible that a smart student will show that there's an attractive orbit of length 173 for unknown values, and this is not chaotic. We do not know that, right? It's delicate. And this is the only picture I have. I say that when I'm very, in much higher dimensions, that's what's happening. You know, I have tangences between various stable and unstable manifolds, but I have no mental capacity to actually show them, and certainly the graduate students don't want to draw them. You know, so I'm just reporting numerical fact. You know, this could be all wrong, but it's very, very intriguing. It's numerical.
Question? Mike?
Mike Graham, Wisconsin. So I'm going to just read back to you what I think was one of the big points. So if you're on the, and you can tell me that I'm wrong. So if you start off your plane there, then you're off the inertial manifold, and you look at a trajectory there, and everything gets squished down. And when you just look at the squishing in phase space, you don't necessarily have any relative reorientation of the vectors. But as soon as you're on the inertial manifold, now you have stretching. If you just take a rubber sheet, pick two random vectors on the rubber sheet and stretch it, then they'll align with each other. And that alignment is what you're,
you know,
measuring.
Doesn't,
so is that totally nonsense?
Doesn't agree, again, you know, everybody's smarter than me on this, doesn't agree with my intuition because, you know, it's a stable manifold, unstable manifold. So you have these two vectors in one, you're stretching like crazy, in the other one you're squishing like crazy, and now they're aligning themselves together.
Yeah, but if you take a rubber sheet and
it makes a nasty pinch. And that pinch shows up, you know, when you compute natural measure on this unknown attractor, it's horrible because at every one of these things, it seems to have a square root singularity because you're pinching the measure there. So it produces pinches. There's nothing nice stretching and smooth.
But
the stretching
most
fails.
Of the time, well, no, you have a smooth vector field, right? You have you're looking at the eigenvectors that you... Well, okay, so unknown, okay, wait, we don't...
Okay, we have more, you know, we have four more weeks for Mike, so that's all right.
Okay, any more urgent questions? Greg.
Greg Huber.
Are you registered at
UCSB?
This conference?
My question is very simple. Why did you give your talk in sunglasses?
Because je suis Hugues Chaté. Yeah,
okay.
But he has shifty eyes, and I have to cover it. No, I have shifty eyes, and I have to cover it.
All right.
Cut it.
So, with that, maybe it's time to move on. From what I understand, that is before dinner, there will be a reception. There will be a little bit of alcohol that smooths maybe the discussions. I want to thank Predrag and all the other speakers in this afternoon sessions. Thank you very much.
Now, as organizer, I have to say you make me very happy. I mean, this group of people is just making me happy.